Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And apparently, this show, as well as all the other podcasts here at WFYI, are available on Spotify. Well... I have guests in studio, ladies and gentlemen. This is a very special Film Sociology because not only is it the last one for 2019 and it's kind of the Christmas show, but I have my family in studio with me.
All the Indiana associates.
Jumping in before her introduction, my daughter Emma, former kids film correspondent here at Film Sociology, and next to her, the most patient woman in the world, Emma's mother, my wife, Lynn Perkins Soucy. Hi, family.
Hi, Daddy.
They came here on their own course. They were not forced into this. I appreciate it. She's just ready to jump into the conversation. That's all right. So if you were expecting a show last week, we apologize. Just things happened, some technical snafus. And if you really want to hear, Bombshell, the acting is good. I wish a woman had directed it, and I wish they'd have dug a little deeper into being a female working at Fox News. But I would expect at least a makeup nomination for the film with the work that was done on Charlize Theron as well as John Lithgow as Roger Ailes. And the new Terrence Malick film, A Hidden Life, he didn't actually hear my rule, where I love Terrence Malick films of the last 10 years. They just need to be 70 minutes longer because I don't know what's going on. This time we have a coherent story, but it's almost 3 hours long. But it looks great. It could have been shorter. Opening in theaters this week, ladies and gentlemen, you have the animated film with Will Smith and Tom Holland, if you're into that. But we'll get into Little Women in a little bit. But I do want to mention opening up on Christmas Day. I remember taking my love show. It was at the last couple Tarantino films opened on Christmas Day, Django mm-hmm. Unchained and Inglourious. Oh, Hateful Eight, mm-hmm. which was my daughter's first Tarantino experience in the theater.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll get to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a little later on as well. But opening and taking its place for, really, this is opening on Christmas Day, the modern-day crime noir Uncut Gems, starring Adam Sandler, and from the brothers that gave us Good Times, which was actually a really good crime film with a really good performance from Robert Pattinson. This time around, Sandler plays a jeweler in New York City who's way up to his body parts in debt and problems, and he winds up meeting with Kevin Garnett and takes one of his championship rings, hocks it for gambling, owes money from everybody, including a very creepy Eric Bogosian. It's actually a really good performance from him. Things are not going well with his family. His soon-to-be ex-wife, played by Idina Menzel, yes. It is a film where Emma just made a face. Yes, Idina Menzel and Adam Sandler are cinematically married. And along with her all issues with his mistress, it reminded me a little bit of the 50s film Night in the City with Richard Widmark, later remade with Robert De Niro. But I mentioned noir because it's a man in a downward spiral. He's making all the bad choices. Seeing how far deep he can sink himself. But it's a really energetic performance from Sandler. His character is a motor mouth, and we've mentioned before when he actually takes direction from directors like Paul Thomas Anderson, like James L. Brooks, like Judd Apatow, even though, of course, we all know Judd Apatow films are always 20 minutes too long. but when he's able to channel the stuff that maybe made him famous at SNL and maybe made him a cinematic irritant, you know, the joke is, what's that one Adam Sandler film where he screams and falls down? Most of them. But anyway, the brothers were able to channel, the filmmakers were able to channel all of that kind of screen stuff that Sandler has done and put it into a really fascinating performance. And at 2 hours and 15 minutes, the film moves. And anyway, if you're into modern crime films, this is one that's worth checking out. And it's one of his best performances. So, with that in mind, I'm glad that the review did not interfere with you working on the cord of your headset.
It's rough.
It's a rough thing.
It's pretty tangled.
But the big film opening this week, and this was a big to-do at the Soucy House because it's also the follow-up for Greta Gerwig of Lady Bird, her film version of Little Women. I'm trying to remember. We have Katherine Hepburn's, Elizabeth Taylor's, Winona Ryder's, and now this. I'm not counting the BBC or the PBS or any PBS incarnations, but it always seems like there every 10 years, either the BBC or PBS, or sometimes in the case of Little Women, Columbia Pictures did in the 90s, every decade or every 20 years, a generation has to have their version of classic literature or plays. And interesting that with the success of Lady Bird for Greta Gerwig as a writer and director, and she had already, I think she was talking while she was promoting Lady Bird that this was going to be her next project. Well, with the success of Lady Bird, we got this. And it's a really, really enjoyable take on the story. I have Lynn and Emma here for, well, besides the fact that they're my family. This is the first one that Emma really latched on to, and she'll back up on that. And Lynn has directed Little Women before, and you've kind of grown up with the book as well, right?
No.
You have not?
Nope.
I was wrong, folks. It's like the dating game here, so.
I was asked to direct it for Indianapolis Civic Theater long ago, and I said, okay, I'm interested. And so I was given a script to read that I think was from the 50s. And I went, ooh, no, I don't like what this has to say about women.
What does it say about women? What
did it say? That they have their place and they need, you know, all the stuff that I don't like.
She's looking at me when she says that.
Then I was given another script, which I think was 1930s, which was better, closer. I obviously went back and read the book. I had never read the book before. Okay. I only knew it as Little Women, and I had opinions about what that meant, and I was not interested. But I read the book, and I'm like, this is good. I like the message. I like this. This is good. So what I ended up doing was asking permission to sort of do my own adaptation, combining some of the other scripts that took out some of the other stuff and really made it more the book, which was lovely. So I think do you remember how old you were when we saw the Winona Ryder?
I think we were in Richmond, so I was probably like 9 or 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I thought, yes, this is good. This is the book. This is nice.
Okay.
And my kid reacted to it in a good way, so I'm cool.
And I should mention as a side note, your directing of Little Women was your first time working with Gene Adams. The only time working with Gene Adams, right? Is Aunt March? Or was that a different production? No?
You're catching me off guard. I'm sorry. I've known Gene so long, I'm thinking, something else I directed?
Well, here's my story. Now that I brought this up, because I did this. Years ago, I was in a show called The Girls of 509. Yes, Emma rolls her eyes. She had a cameo in that. But I was in this production and we were in rehearsal in the dead of winter. And 2 weeks before we opened, there was a casting change. Our lead, who was a wonderful lady but also very frail, had to drop out. And taking her spot, and I remember seeing this woman leave the parking lot as I was pulling in. Hey, what's that? And I go into the theater, and there's my director with this little red-haired lady with little funky glasses. And Judy, our director, announced that there was a casting change, and here is Jean, and she's a wonderful lady. And I gave the worst first impression, that everybody saw me roll my eyes and sigh loudly. And I – so anyway, we go into rehearsal, and – she's got energy. She can move. And even though she's playing an old lady, we had some little electricity on stage. There was, as an actor and as a person, I would help the other actress in and out of her chair. Just, you know, so it, on stage, it kind of looked like being a gentleman. I did this a couple of times with Jean, and she finally turned to me. I can get out of my chair. I'm fine. Thank you. So I was like, ooh.
Yeah, I don't think Meryl Streep would have let you
help her. No. So anyway, we get through the rehearsal. It's a good run. And I just went over and I kissed her on top of her head. And then I came home to you, and this is why I brought this up, was she goes, how's rehearsal? And I said, oh, it's fine, but we got a casting change, and the lead is out. Oh, who's taking over? And I said, some woman named Jean Adams. And you went, oh, I directed her as Aunt March. You'll love her. She's great. And and then the next day, she found out who I came over and told her who you were and how my how we were a couple. And that, of course, she knew your family for decades. So anyway, yes, there was an Aunt March moment. But yeah, Meryl Streep does not need help getting in and out of her chairs. So the big thing about this for me is, and it's been talked about, is the adaptation of this. We begin and end the film with Joe as a writer dealing with the publisher, played by Terry Letts, aka playwright Terry Letts, aka her dad from Little Women or from Lady Bird. And so, and there's also a non-linear storytelling for you Tarantino fans.
That was the first thing I found myself thinking as we were moving into the film was like, ooh, I like that it's not straight out the novel. Mm-hmm. We're doing some, Emma, big vocabulary words, in medias rex,
yeah.
That we're looking from, we're starting from the standpoint where Jo is in New York and she's starting to have a career or try to develop the career as the writer. And then very quickly recognizing, oh, we're going to be cutting back and forth in time a lot, that this was a new, fresh look at the story of Little Women from a more contemporary viewpoint was what I assumed as we started out. And then as we moved into it, I went, yep, that's what we're doing.
I also really liked, Little Women has the reputation of like, oh, it is long and boring to some and about nothing, which is not true, but I think...
Did you punch those people in the throat when they say that to you?
I mean, I thought it really loudly, the structure of this adaptation, I think... gives the audience a clearer purpose for the story. Like it outlines, hey, here's where we are, so here's why you need to know all of this other stuff from when we were young. Like it feels like their time together as children is supporting what we're learning now about their like current lives as adults.
Yeah, I think you said when the film was first over, you said something rather like, it's just somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
But that with this version, because we're coming at it from the adult moment in time, it is very much explaining how we got here, or in this moment, these other things are resonating with me, whether it's conscious or not.
Yeah. And I've been very into like nonlinear storytelling. Because I'm that person.
Well, and you'd also watch Tarantino at a fairly young age.
Right.
Like, I thank myself for that.
Well, and to be clear, the credit on screen is not, this is the book. It's
right.
Based on Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. So we saw it actually with some friends of ours, and one of whom is a novelist.
Yes. Hi, Kate. I swear we'll get you on, Kate, and you can promote the book and do an hour on Little Women.
And I totally get that this is not the novel. But I also found myself remarking in my experience, when somebody falls in love with something, they always love the first version best.
Right.
And so you're always comparing from there.
You mean my high school production was better than this cinematic thing that was...
Yes.
On occasion.
I have run into that definitely with students and other audience members. It's like, well, the Broadway version was not nearly as good as our high school production. Like, okay. So I'm glad you fell in love with that source material.
Right.
But I definitely found myself, you know, before having conversations with other people, just watching it going, okay, so I like that this is a new, fresh take. I like that I'm getting more out of the story than I expected because I know the book and previous productions. I just lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
But I'm also intrigued as to what Greta is because we know her so well, is, you know, what's her angle? What is she trying to lift up as we go along? And so part of what I appreciated was having more sense of what's going on with Amy and Laurie in Europe and getting more sort of the essence of the book. And I would say probably part of the take of why we want to tell this story this way to this audience today is what's a woman's place in the world? Because, you know, it's still a challenge. And it's changing, but to be able to use this story to illuminate some other things is useful.
CEOs have been, men running CEOs have dropped from 99.9% to 98.7%. My family's looking at me. I'm going to go away.
Well, I mean, you know, like the long-haired, silvery white guy over there cutting off my mother from trying to express herself. To make his quip.
I heard an interview on NPR just a few days ago that was talking about, you know, are we really making a difference in Hollywood with the whole Me Too movement in just a year? And they're like, only asking for 4%. But part of the pitch was, well, if every production would make a 4% difference, that can add up pretty fast. So anyway, yes, there's a nice statement here about women recognizing where their power was and what the choices were that they had, as opposed to, you could read the book, I think, and just go, oh, they didn't have much agency.
Mm-hmm.
Or they did the best with what they had. But this, I think, lifts up some cultural stuff that's useful in the now.
Absolutely.
And so also, it was fun. And also with Kate, like I said, we'll get her on the show. But it was so, I love this, and then I hate that, but I love this. And
they cut this scene. I love that part.
Right. So I was talking earlier before we got in studio. A while back, I had somebody ask me about, should they remake Casablanca? And I kind of, like old film guy, just went, oh, God, no. and then she hit me with the responses, but the umpteenth version of Little Women is coming out. And there have been a slew of remakes done recently because it's a familiar name. I'm still, yes, Emma.
Well, I was going to say, like,
please.
I think, you know, the purpose of good remakes.
She's looking at me when she says
that. I feel like the purpose of a good remake is not to make the thing better or like in any objective way, but it's just to put it in another form that will appeal to and get to the root of like another group of people. As opposed to a just total, we're scrapping everything from before and redoing it just because we can or because we want to sell some merch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we have seen those, a total, like, rehash. And I think, you know, I don't know Casablanca that well. How old was I when I saw that?
In the Soucy house, I have shown my daughter a slew of films over the years. There is a section of her life we call the early years. It's kind of like the cinematic version of, oh, honey, you went to London, but I was two. I don't remember that. I was not showing her Casablanca at two. But
I was young, and I don't remember
it. You were fairly young, and you remember. I think we watched it here because I had a rule. If she had to go to work with me on a Saturday as opposed to sitting at my computer desk for 5, 6, 7 hours.
Watching cat videos?
Yes. We would watch a movie, a classic movie. This very studio where we are recording the show right now, this is where she saw Sunset Boulevard. This is where she saw Casablanca, Cabaret, and a few others. So
anywho.
Any whoosies.
If my memory serves me, it's considered, you know, a masterpiece, a classic kind of thing.
Yes, it is.
And if something is, you know, that masterful, if you feel that the one way it was made is the best way possible, and like it will be, you can't do it another way to make it more appealing to other people, then I don't see a point in remaking something. But I think Little Women, because it can be so universal, not just to people with sisters and people with moms, or I mean, which is most people, but because it is a very universal story, and it is one that has worked its way through years and years of media. Clearly, it's important enough to people that the remaking of it is valuable so that new generations can process it and apply it to their own lives.
Right. So there are times where something gets remade for commercial reasons. We
sure.
can make more money off of it.
Yep.
But there, as an artist, you know, why tell a Shakespeare play that's been done a gazillion times over the last several hundred years over and over again? Any classic story is a classic because there's something that's relevant today. Why do we still have interest in Greek and Roman stories, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the essence of an old story through our contemporary lens because it's going to tell us something about today or help us to reflect on something today.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece is so many films come from some kind of source material. Mm-hmm. There certainly are original stories. Lots of times it's a novel that a few people read, and so
right.
they don't go in going, oh, this is fabulous, or I hate it because I love the novel better. But the source material comes from somewhere. So why aren't there a gazillion To Kill a Mockingbirds? Why aren't there a gazillion Casablancas? I go back to R. Keith Michael, Intro to Theater, IU, right? It's like, well, how do you know it's a work of art? And the definition, at least that I recall at the time, was if it does what it does in the best way possible within that medium, it's a work of art. So why remake that work of art,
right?
But we have a new To Kill a Mockingbird.
We do, because community theaters are hurting because of it.
Well, and society has changed,
yes.
thank heaven, and we're looking at things differently. So will there eventually be a new version of To Kill a Mockingbird because you want to bring to light the classic stuff that is really relevant, but let's not focus on what wasn't so much anymore? Who knows?
Yeah. I said to this person, Casablanca is based off of a play, if I remember right, called Everybody Comes to Rick's. If you want to make a film version of that or a stage version of that, that's intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it this way. The other thing that came to light was I was reminded, because I actually saw an episode, I believe it was 1980. There was a television series of Casablanca.
That sounds bad.
With David Soul and Hector Elizondo as Claude Rains and Scatman Crothers as Sam. Now, I'm not kidding, folks. Go on YouTube, look it up. It's there. Don't need that either. But I like you were saying, you know, you had issues with the 30s. Adaptation of Little Women and a 50s adaptation.
These are play scripts.
Play scripts. I know. But it seems like, as I was mentioning, the PBS and BBC are like, okay, it's our turn to do this or that. But the adaptation of it, what you do, and yes, as we heard from our invisible friend Kate, you know, I love this and I wish that part was back in and I wish that part. This version adapted and directed by Greta, our friend Greta. But it doesn't feel like,
I would say based on.
Based on?
I clarify. If you want to see the novel, this is not going to make you happy. This is not this is not a film adaptation of the novel.
Okay.
This is based on. This is more Joe's story than Little Women.
Okay.
And in a sense, it's Louisa May Alcott's story to the degree that it's autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that is in the film is clarification about Louisa May Alcott's choice to change the ending of the mm-hmm. novel from
yes.
what she wanted it to be,
mm-hmm.
which is also a story worth knowing.
So,
one of the things that our novel loving friends were concerned about was that somebody who didn't know the novel wouldn't be able to follow it because it cuts back and forth in time so much. I hear that. And I'm curious to see if other people respond that way. But the person sitting next to me who saw one version when she was very young said,
I got it.
And you're young.
Yeah.
The kids today with their.
Right. I saw the Winona Ryder. I guess not that young, but I don't remember it. I just remember Winona Ryder.
I love her. And I know a lot of people that is going to be like theirs. And that's
yeah.
the other, you can have more than one. It is okay.
It is allowed.
You know, there's actually some validity to the Tim Burton mm-hmm. Chocolate Factory movie. Sorry, there is. But we'll save that for another time. You can. Both shows. You're both pretty. You're both good adaptations.
And, I tried to read the book in like the fourth or fifth grade and I was. I'm interested.
Would you want to read it now?
Maybe. Okay. Maybe.
That's a start.
Yeah, but I think the art direction is clear enough from where are we in the present or the past? Like that works.
That's one of the things the novel lovers were noticing is like, oh, it has this look now. So now I have the clues that we're in a different time frame.
Yeah, like the first few flips back and forth. If Joe going to the publisher is very clearly not her at home with everyone. There are one or two that I was like, okay, gotcha.
Different casting issues might have helped a bit in that it is the same for actresses playing the sisters mm-hmm. at all ages.
Yes.
Which means that Amy's behavior when she, I think, in the book is actually much younger than she appears to be in the film seems a little bit more
obnoxious.
Problematic.
Wow, that was good.
Well, and that's, I mean, again, I don't really know other versions, but I can very much see how, like, if it were told fully linear, and if you didn't get that time with Amy in Paris, how she would be awful. Like, how you would be what a brat. But getting to see Amy in Paris and getting to know her as you know her when she's younger, like,
because you're going back and forth. So
right.
You see the resonance, the similars, the differences.
Not to be like that Sex and the City person, but like I'm such an Amy. Like, and I appreciate.
Is that a Facebook quiz? Which March sister are you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure it's out there. BuzzFeed is on it.
I was actually surprised by Amy, and I think in part because we were getting to know the adult Amy
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Before. The Nimini Pippet? I can't remember what the phrase Limini is.
Snicket.
No.
Nimini Pippities.
Whatever they call her when she's young. Because, you know, if you just meet her when she's that bratty young kid trying to get attention, you have that opinion as she's moving through life. But because you see who she became, you then can understand maybe what informed those choices and where she's at.
Absolutely.
And let's never forget, Christopher Columbus is the MF of this era, apparently.
It's not appropriate for a girl.
From my standpoint, another thing that I think was a goal for the filmmaker, for Greta, our friend Greta, was, you know, to take, and this has been happening over the last 20 years or so with a lot of the Shakespeare films, is to kind of remove the quote-unquote masterpiece theater
right.
brand, because I think people associate masterpiece, well, obviously the master with PBS, and they think it's costumes and stuffy.
Well, and
not
people
really
who think that Shakespeare is all stuffy and you gotta blow the dust off is like, no, actually meet what he wrote.
Yeah,
right?
So, and in this, you have the nonlinear storytelling. I was also, at times, as I was watching this, it reminded me of a Robert Altman film where there's a lot of overlapping dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Which you don't generally see in the classic literature, even though we all talk all over each other, especially me, at the same time.
And it really appeals to the, you know, like the Miss Maisel, Gilmore Girls, Fleabag, like those people who like those shows, I think, which
it's a more contemporary tempo.
Right.
Rhythm
yeah.
of
and
speech.
I in my brain, you know, my
18-year-old brain.
My 18-year-old brain, like that to me feels like a very accurate representation of being a woman in the modern day.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting to have that tempo also put me in like the right headspace to receive the information in Little Women.
Well, and it's nice that we're spending all this time with these females, Marmee included and Hannah, you know, in their world being comfortable being themselves, and then we start to get a glimpse of the people outside, how they respond to them,
mm-hmm.
Aunt March and Mr. Lawrence and Mr. Brooke and all of that, so that by the time we go back to, oh, and when they leave their little nest, their little bubble world, and they have to go out and deal with Tracy Letts, the publisher,
yes.
right? And then there's some nice little additional scenes there of what's affecting the publisher's choices about the women in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, is it the novel? No. Does our screenwriter tell us a story that helps us maybe see our world in a different way and think back to the world that was and how that affects where we are? Yes. And it's entertaining and it's delightful.
So big,
and really nice performances.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah,
so, or say Saoirse Ronan as Joe, Emma Watson as Meg, Florence Pugh, who I also enjoyed earlier this year in Midsummer as Amy, Eliza Scanlon as Beth, Laura Dern's old enough to be Marmee now, and Meryl Streep is old enough to be Aunt March now.
Woo.
So, yes, Tracy Letts, as I mentioned, Chris Cooper, Mr. Lawrence. I'm a big Chris Cooper fan, and so to see him in a period piece, it's not quite Donald Sutherland in Pride and Prejudice, but it's really cool. So I watch that and go, I want to play this role if somebody does this show. Bob Odenkirk, yes, thank you, Greta Gerwig, for having Bob Odenkirk and Laura Dern as a married couple. It's like your mother and me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, really, really fun performances.
Who
across
plays
the
Laurie?
Board. Oh, yes, Timothy Chalamet.
The prettiest.
As Chris Lloyd fell from critics says, the prettiest of the March sisters.
Absolutely.
But also, I like Timothy Chalamet's work for the most part. It's nice to see him in something where he's not self-destructive and suicidal.
Yeah.
Lucas Hedges,
he's
you
just
too.
A terminal boy.
Right. Yes, so.
But that's a part of the story, and watching sort of where he grows up. And I didn't hear our friend's remark when he did get to that more adult place. But part of what you love about him is he has that youthful spirit and that joy of life that's brought out in him and validated when he runs into the March family.
Exactly. So yeah, fun stuff there. So yeah, I'm really happy this is out there. I do want to go back and revisit Gillian Armstrong's version with Winona and Meryl. And Aunt March does more in this one than our girl Mary Wicks as Aunt March, who sleeps very, very well. And then, I can't even remember the last time I watched the Katharine Hepburn version, which was a long, 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 long time ago.
Well, I was just thinking, I'm assuming that these last two versions are the only ones directed by women.
There is that. There is. I believe that. We'll have to double check that and see if that's true. So, but yeah, and so good. So yeah, we don't do thumbs. We don't do things. But yeah, go see it. It's in theaters. You should really, if you need a break from your family. Yeah, see it also in a big screen. Because
if you can.
I know I was kind of talking about this with The Irishman earlier this month. Because there's nonlinear storytelling, the theater's a gathering place, as a lovely lady once told me, but especially because if you're not used to stories going back and forth timeline wise, doing this while you're doing the dishes, probably not the wisest idea. So
sit down to
watch
it.
Focus.
Yeah, give it your focus as well. You should anywhere really
take you on a journey.
Yeah. So that is in theaters now. I do want to mention, a couple things. We're going to wrap things up with the end of the year stuff because I'm obligated, sort of, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
The big title, small week for video releases. The big title this week is Judy, the Renee Zellweger biopic, not a biopic, of Judy Garland in her stretch in London. And some are calling this a comeback for Ms. Zellweger. I don't think she ever really went away, but this is a higher profile piece for her. And it's not about her entire life. It is just her experience when she was trying to do some live shows in London. We do get a little bit of flashbacks of her as a child, and it's just a brutal reminder, 20th century movie executives sucked because they kind of literally fed her a life that nobody should really have. But Renee, I believe, does her own singing in this film. It's a biopic where it's kind of standard biopic
arc,
but a really anchored with a really solid performance.
Yeah.
So if you're a Renee Zellweger fan or a Judy Garland fan, this is worth checking out. Okay, because we didn't have a show last week, sorry, gang, I wasn't able to announce the Indiana Film Journalists Association's 2019 awards. We had hours of negotiations at an undisclosed place in Indianapolis. So, you know, these do anything for you, folk, family. We can watch these. So, oh, drum roll. Thank you for the air drum roll. Thanks. Our best film, according to the IFJA, is Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. Fun for the holidays for the family. This is a film that's made my top 10 list. It's probably arguably one of the best films about divorce. And yes, I'm talking about Kramer versus Kramer. Lou Harry, of course, brings up Alan Parker's Shoot the Moon. That's also, don't watch these films in a row, Emma.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't want to. Yeah,
no triple headers.
Oh my gosh, no! I'm sorry. Can I tell the?
Yeah.
So one time, Emma had the great idea of watching. She wanted to watch Sophie's Choice, and Schindler's List.
Oh, my.
So
I still haven't seen either.
No, we're working on that.
One at a time.
But yeah, please, one at a time. And then, yeah, as I believe your mother said, you know, it's unfair to the second film.
Yeah, whichever
so,
it is.
Yeah, whatever it is. So anyway, our winner was Marriage Story. Our runner-up was the Korean film Parasite. Our finalist, we have an honorable mention, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. These are in alphabetical.
Woo.
Booksmart,
mm-hmm.
Ford versus Ferrari, Knives Out, The Lighthouse, Little Women, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Our winner for Best Animated Feature. I'm sorry. You can also hear my ballot sometimes when I read these. Best Animated Feature winner was How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. The runner-up, I Lost My Body, which, if you get a chance, look for it. It's a French animated film about a severed hand trying to find its owner. So imagine Thing getting his own little adventure with a boy trying to find a girl. And that's the other part. Best foreign language film, Parasite, of course, from the director of Snowpiercer and The Host. Runner-up, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. A new twist on the artist falling in love with his muse, or in this case, her muse. Female painter painting a bride-to-be, and it's a low, slow smolder, but it works. Best documentary winner is for Sama. Runner-up, Apollo 11. Best original screenplay to Noah Baumbach for Marriage Story. Runner-up, Robert Eggers and Max Eggers for The Lighthouse. And if you want to see Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe chew scenery big time stuck in a lighthouse in the 19th century, check that out. Best Adapted Screenplay, Greta Gerwig for Little Women. Runner-up, Micah Fitzerman-Blue and Noah Harpster for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Making a Mr. Rogers Story not the star, but making the film like an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I still want to live in that little model town that he has. Best Director, Bong Joon-ho for Parasite. Pardon my Korean. And runner-up, Celine Sciamma, pardon my French, for Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Best Actress, Lupita Nyong'o for Us. And runner-up, Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story. Best Supporting Actress, Jennifer Lopez for Hustlers. And our runner-up was Taylor Russell for Waves. Best Actor, Adam Driver, Mishawaka's own Adam Driver for Marriage Story, and don't play clips around him. Runner-up, Adam Sandler for Uncut Gems, which opened this week. Best Supporting Actor, Willem Dafoe for The Lighthouse. Runner-up, Brad Pitt, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I took Emma. We've seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood twice, my daughter and I, because the first time we were a little late. We missed the first 5 minutes, and then they were showing it at IMAX, and then the film became Attack of the 70-Foot Brad Pitt.
I'm not complaining.
Not at all. We'll get to Once Upon a Time, because guess what? It made my list. Best vocal/motion capture performance role, Jason Lyles, Alex Maxson, and Richard Dorton, all playing Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And a runner-up, Rosa Salazar for Alita Battle Angel, which was one of the films I watched in the plane heading to Edinburgh.
Nice.
A Robert Rodriguez film. Best Ensemble Acting, our winner was Knives Out. Runner-up was Little Women. Best Musical Score, Michael Abels for Us. Runner-up, Cavern of Antimatter for In Fabric. Breakout of the Year, Olivia Wilde for her directing of Booksmart. As I said, the best John Hughes film not written or directed by John Hughes. Runner-up, Roman Griffin Davis for Jojo Rabbit. The Original Vision Award goes to Robert Eggers for The Lighthouse. Runner-up, Bong Joon-ho for Parasite. And our Hoosier Award winner, Jason Keller, as the screenwriter for Ford versus Ferrari. Have a great sound system when watching Ford versus Ferrari. So, okay, here's my obligatory top 10 list. The best films, according to me, for 2019. And in 3 months, this list might change. But it's not a bad list. If you look through what didn't make the top 10 and what is in your honorable mentions, you're like, wow, that didn't make it. That's a good year. It was a good year. My number 10, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which I talked about, French smoldering woman and muse. Number 9, Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. watch it at once. Don't. I know there's a thing online where they're breaking it up like it's a mini series. First off, why aren't you doing that with the Avengers? And so you don't need that. But yeah, a nice button. I think this might be Scorsese's final crime drama. And it ends on a somber note, not like Goodfellas, not like Casino. Number eight, The Lighthouse. As I mentioned, it's a battle of wills matched with Haunted House Story in a lighthouse with really over-the-top Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. Number seven, the domestic drama Waves, which we mentioned before. It's a kind of a two-part story. What happens with the son in the first half, and then the daughter picks up in the second half of that film. Also, Taylor Russell being the daughter, she was our runner-up for Best Supporting Actress. Lucas Hedges in a non-angst-ridden role. And somebody who's starting to become, I guess, one of our guys in the Soucy household, Sterling K. Brown, as the dad, for you fans of This Is Us. Number six, I mentioned Booksmart. I am really happy, and I know, Emma, that you need to watch the films of John Hughes, I suppose. But I'm really happy that you have had a really, really good streak of teen, not necessarily teen angst, but teen comedy dramas like Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, like Edge of 17, Perks of Being a Wallflower, and Booksmart. So I like that one. But yeah, kudos to the and there's even an animated section in Booksmart, which I think is an homage to the animated section in Better Off Dead. Film nerds do that. Number five, Greta Gerwig's Little Women. Number four, and I hope more people see this film. Chris Lloyd is also with me on this. I believe it's on Netflix. The Last Black Man in San Francisco from director Joe Talbot. About two friends. It's one of the more beautiful films about squatting. It's two guys who have taken up residence in an empty brownstone house in San Francisco. One of the guys says that his grandfather built this house from scratch. It at times feels like a West Coast Do the Right Thing. We also get a look at non-cinematic San Francisco. So it's a lovely piece. It's a kind of an atmosphere. This is where you're just cinematically hanging out for a couple hours and a beautiful house. Number three, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I didn't mind the length. It's not as bloody as his other revisionist revenge films. But then the whole aspect of what DiCaprio's character is going through in Hollywood, that's a fascinating era for me, the late 60s. It's just a lot of fun. And let it be known, I've listened to that soundtrack
so many times
at your request. Yeah. So if anything else, my daughter has now done a deep dive in late 60s pop. So thanks, Quentin.
Hell yeah.
appreciate that. Number two, Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. We will have Haagen-Dazs afterwards when watching it. But Lynn, do you remember watching Blue Valentine with me? It's not quite that depressing.
Okay, good.
Not quite that. Well, and Noah Baumbach, I think, has had a really great streak of films. Mistress America, Frances Ha, Squid and the Whale, Meyerowitz Stories. And this is kind of his take on divorce. Not saying it's based on his divorce, but there's some really, really funny stuff in this film. And it balances out with some heartbreaking scenes, and it's on paper it's what I think civilized human beings want to do. It's a couple that want to get divorced, but they don't want lawyers involved, and then the lawyers get involved. So, and my number one film, I'm the only one that I think this was in their top 10, but it brought me so much cinematic joy earlier this year, and I think also the fact that technology has caught up, and no, it's not Avengers, and it's not anything else CG or Star Wars, but it was able to be finally fixed and put out there, and it's I'm a big fan of the old school concert films, The Last Waltz, Woodstock, even Stop Making Sense. My number one film of 2019 is the Aretha Franklin concert film Amazing Grace. Now, the story on this was, I believe, 1971. Aretha Franklin told Atlantic Records that her next album was going to be a gospel album, and it was going to be a live gospel album at a church in Watts. So that album, it was going to be recorded over two nights with a choir, with, I believe, the Reverend Cleveland, and Warner Brothers was going to film it. They had already had huge success with Woodstock in 1970, and they brought in Indiana filmmaker Sidney Pollack, who is just fresh off of making They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Also a film you don't want to watch at Christmas time. And he was going to film it. So the story was they filmed it, and the sync between sound and picture didn't happen. So Warner Brothers shelved the film. Yeah. Now, however, Atlantic got their album, Amazing Grace, to this day in 2019. It is not only Aretha Franklin's biggest selling album of her discography, it's also still the biggest selling live gospel album ever. And what you see in this film, finally, because technology has caught up and they were able to put it together, it's guerrilla filmmaking. There's footage of Sidney Pollack pointing to other cameras like, shoot that. Like Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones show up for a service, I guess. There's a lot of footage of just seeing the camera come into focus and Aretha, her eyes closed, face covered in sweat, absolutely at the top of her vocal powers. And the fact that it just brought me joy, and the fact that this little cinematic Holy Grail finally got released, it meant a lot to me. So, hi, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. But go, look for it. Look for it. It is out there, and I really, really enjoyed it. So, how you guys doing?
Okay.
So, just so folks know, and we're not going to do a deep dive into our family psyche. This is a podcast. It's not family therapy.
Boy.
But what are our Christmas cinematic traditions? Because it should be known, Emma is 18. She's a senior in high school. And I think now when you will be going away to college. But I also know that there will be things like, when I get home, I want to eat here. I would like mom to cook this. I want you to show me this. And I know you're going to want to watch stuff. So what is on the holiday movie wish list?
Number one, you can fight. Anyone can fight me on this. I know you won't because you agree with me because I'm right. A Muppet's Christmas Carol is the greatest recorded Christmas carol.
Only because they didn't film the IRT productions with your mom in it.
Absolutely. That's why I specified recorded.
And White Christmas.
Yes, White Christmas is on the list.
Wait, if I may, can we go back to your choice? So,
yes.
You're not the only one that says Muppet Christmas Carol is the definitive Christmas Carol for them.
Of course, I'm right. So, other people would agree with being right
because you have a classic piece of literature and Muppets.
And Muppets.
And this
well, and we did go through our whole The Muppets Classic theater trip.
We did do that. And it's funny because earlier this year there was a stretch on Twitter, I believe, that said, okay, you can make any movie with Muppets, but you keep one human.
Yes.
So now we had already had, in real life, Muppet Christmas Carol, Muppet Treasure Island.
Muppet Wizard of Oz
we had. So Lynn, would you like to share your contribution, which just spawned, at least in our household, forget Twitter.
Muppet Glass Menagerie.
So
Miss Piggy, of course, is Amanda.
That goes without saying.
Right. And Kermit is Tom.
Yes.
We sometimes talk about, do we have Kermit and Robin do younger Tom and adult Tom? I kind of like just Kermit doing it.
Dear Henson family.
Fozzie, of course, is the gentleman caller.
Gonzo is angry. Gonzo is really ticked.
And we've had debates about, I think initially I said the animal's girlfriend in the drum was Laura. And then we went to, can we steal one from Sesame Street and let it be the fairy girl?
Oh, what was her name? Anyway.
And then we went, wait a minute, there has to be a human.
And I suggested Emma Watson for that. So
so Laura gets to be the human.
Yeah. So that's not bad. I think I wrote I can't find the thread, and I know I read this on the show, but I believe I wrote Schindler's List, keep Ralph Fiennes.
What about
Amadeus, keep F. Murray Abraham.
The new Little Women, keep Meryl Streep.
With all Muppets.
With all
who,
Muppets.
Who, what
we
Muppet
don't have
females?
That many female characters.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
No, no, no. Let's hear the. No, I was saying Piggy would have to be Aunt March.
I was going to say Piggy as Aunt March would make more sense.
Don't tell Piggy that.
Shoot.
Bang.
Okay, so White Christmas, definitely.
White Christmas.
Which we couldn't get you to watch when you were younger, but now you're
well, no, and okay. This is the great thing, because the art doesn't change, you change.
Right,
and
I just didn't have taste.
And
then.
When we mention White Christmas, I have to mention this. One of my favorite moments in cinema, on behalf of all quote-unquote character actors everywhere, because my wife says all actors are character actors. Mm-hmm. But you non-headliners out there, when Mary Wicks smacks Bing Crosby on the lips with a big old kiss, and he responds favorably. The sidekicks of the world jumped up and cheered.
Yay.
And that's one of my favorite moments in White Christmas. And as somebody wrote in the I will sidestep the story. I was emceeing a Christmas event, and I was hosting trivia, and somebody mentioned, you know, who were the stars of White Christmas, and this was a woman that wrote, young thin Rosemary Clooney.
Oh.
And I said on the mic, you know, old fat Rosemary Clooney would knock you down and take your drink and take your man, and there wasn't anything you could do about it. You know, George's aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And she would totally hit on George's friends. So, yeah, White Christmas, definitely.
I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's not Santa Claus is Coming to Town, but the Kris Kringle origin story one.
Oh, with Mickey Rooney
as
and,
Santa.
And
the Rankin Bass.
Fred Astaire as the narrator, as the poster.
Yeah. Yes, that's my favorite Rankin Bass, closely followed by Rudolph. Yeah, I like him.
Yeah, and then we moved from movies to TV
specials. Yeah, we...
Yes.
Kind of like a choir show.
Right. Okay.
Sorry.
That was a vicious attack.
I'm sorry. You called me out on my own show, so that's all right.
Okay.
So, yeah, Charlie Brown Christmas, definitely. That's
absolutely.
Still the best. That's still my favorite Christmas album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other, not a Christmas movie, but the other one that we
watched
that I didn't know anything about that I loved was The Biggest Little Farm.
Oh, yes.
It's just a good feel-good thing.
A documentary of a couple, a very earnest married couple that decided to build a
farm.
Guess what? It's hard.
It's hard.
It's expensive.
And he's a cinematographer who did some incredible work over the years that puts together this story in a beautiful way.
Well, and it's not just like starting we do two crops. Like, it's what makes it hard.
Diversified organic farm.
Yeah, it is. The genetic diversity and making nature like work for you, but like figuring out what animal is going to be enough of a pest to eat the snails, but not enough of the pest to kill the chickens. Like,
that's a tough call.
It is.
We definitely came out of it going, okay, how can we make the whole world work like that?
Yeah.
Yes. Dear world.
Thank you.
Watch this.
Fix it.
So, all right. Well, family, thanks for indulging your husband/father
of
this
show.
What are the holidays for?
Merry Christmas. This is a present.
No, this is not. See, I've been at the radio station long enough now, 20 years. I still remember being live at the Slippery Noodle on our anniversary, and that was the first time I did the crack of, I want to wish my wife, Mrs. Lynn, thank you for letting me call you Mrs. Sosie on the radio. And yes, mentioning our anniversary on the radio does not count as a gift. So, but yeah, so enjoy your holidays no matter how you celebrate or what you celebrate or what. And by the way, I'd like to think I speak on behalf of the family when I say, I don't care what is and isn't a Christmas movie.
No.
And yet you say Die Hard, and I was an extra in Die Hard 2, so I'm part of the franchise, not really. I don't care. I was watching Dark Waters, the Mark Ruffalo lawyer against, you know, big water film, and there's a scene set at Christmas time.
Christmas movie.
So I wrote, boom. It's a Christmas movie.
Well, you know, why is It's a Wonderful Life a Christmas movie?
And yeah, one of my goals, and I wish I could have the venue to do it, but one of my goals as a director someday is to do It's a Wonderful Life in non-November, non-December, because it's a life-affirming story.
I was going to say Easter might make more sense.
But, you know, then again, we have to thank / blame the networks, because apparently The Ten Commandments is an Easter movie, and
Passover.
The Wizard of Oz is a Thanksgiving movie? No.
Yeah.
No.
Always happened around that time.
Yeah. So.
Well, what's the spirit of the movie and who are you seeing it with and how does that movie function in your life might be the way of thinking of what's the holiday movie for you right now.
There you go. Emma, we've not done Dark Side of the Moon, Wizard of Oz yet with you, have I?
No.
We should. I'll add that to the list. The list is always growing.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you, family.
You're welcome.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz is spoken. We're going to end the show today with a now film sociology holiday tradition, a collaboration between Beatrice Hartz and Hans Zimmer. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Have a great holiday, and we'll talk films in 2020 after the new year. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Merry Christmas, Fort Myers. Merry Christmas, California. Merry Christmas, Michigan.
Jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it to ride on the one hope and say, hey, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it to ride on the one horse open say, hey,
yay!
Jingle bells, jingle.